the parable of the three rings, the indistinguishability of religious traditions. Once again, it strikes me quite clearly that you cannot remain a committed traditional Jew and buy such an idea without some problem. Which is to say, if it's really true that the three faiths are indistinguishable, where does that leave the Jews in Christian Europe, or frankly the Jews in more Muslim countries? It's always easier to be part of the majority for a whole variety of reasons that you hardly need to tell a Jew in the 18th, 19th, 20th, or frankly now the 21st century. And again, when you pick up his Jerusalem, you begin seeing how he wants to sort of warn against such ideas. What he actually does, though, is he links this idea of the inability to distinguish between the three religious traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and links it to another idea, but it is a related idea, which he refers to as the union of faith. Clearly, there are people already in the 18th century following, I think, along the lines of what Lessing is saying, that argue, again, clearly Christians, who argue that, look, if at their base and at their core, these religious traditions are indistinguishable. We don't know who has the true ring. We don't have the ability. In fact, we shouldn't ever be standing up and sort of claiming that kind of exclusivity. That perhaps what we should do is finally give up on all these religious wars and all the bloodshed and the torture and the torment of having Jews, Christians, and Muslims in the world, and work towards a union of faiths. If we all believe the same thing at core, why don't we work to that? Why don't we just drop all our differences and embrace the same set of truths? And there was some kind of messianic vision that I think some of these very progressive individuals were trying to articulate. And right at the end of his Jerusalem, Mendelssohn, he ends with exactly this point. And it is just so interesting, I think, to think about. He says, let's just suppose for a moment, God forbid, he says, he does say this, let's just suppose for a moment that we allowed ourselves to do this. That we made a move to saying, nope, you cannot distinguish between the faiths, let's have one faith that stands at the middle. How will we do this? So this is what we would call faith by committee, I suppose. Which is to say, all of us sitting in this room, we would have a wonderful conference here. I'm sure Torah in Motion would be very pleased to sponsor such a thing. You have a group of Christians and Muslims and Jews sitting exactly around a horseshoe table, maybe a square table so that there's no head and no front. You know, we all sit very, very equally, and we start formulating for ourselves what exactly is the essence of faith. What is the essence of belief? We would do it. We'd lock ourselves in the room. It might take a day, might take a week, might take a month, might take a few years. I don't know how long it'll take. But seemingly at some point, Mendelssohn says, we'd come out with some formulation. He says, and that's when the problems begin. Because what happens? So number one, it's clearly, and you're absolutely right, it ends up being a lowest common denominator. But nevertheless, Mendelssohn said, intelligent, sensitive people will come up with something. But now comes the problem. All you have done is substituted one dogma for another. Why? Because if we all in this room finally agree on a union of faith, right, we have to leave the room by saying, okay, this is now our Ikar, or Ikarim. And it's carefully formulated. Why does it have to be carefully formulated? Partly because the gentleman said it's right. It is the lowest common denominator, but you have to word it just so carefully that each of us could, understand that what we believe is somehow found in that. And then Mendelssohn's next two lines are wonderful. He says, that's right. And the day after we finally agreed, someone raises his hand and objects. Someone interprets the words differently. Someone adds something else to the stake with him. Because he or she is a disturber of the peace. Mendelssohn says this would be horrific. In some ways, very interestingly, I think he has a very little bit of an anticipation of what a totalitarian state would be like. And he says, God forbid. So effectively what he does, and he ends that text with a plea for, I think, what we would call pluralism, a plea for saying no, that a true liberal society is a society that allows each one of us to live by our own beliefs, our own articulation of beliefs as they are. And we must absolutely respect that. Now, having said that, though, it is the same Mendelssohn who elsewhere in that same text, I will return to this point, who unabashedly would say that halakha is not only what defines us, but, again, this is where a whole other discussion could take place, not only what defines us, halakha is not only what makes us unique, but is also what makes our tradition superior. And the reason he argued that, again, I can only give it to you really in short form, is that he sees a huge difference between traditional Judaism and Protestant Christianity. In what sense? Because ultimately he felt that what Protestant Christians had to embrace were a simple set of ideas. Not ritual, but a simple set of ideas. And he believed that that is not the path to true faith. That in fact, it is by living by the Torah, which is to say, by doing mitzvot, which is also to say, really, by doing actions. You keep Shabbat, you're doing things. You're not just simply reciting formulae, you're not just simply reciting ideas, which he felt to be far too superficial, and sort of create a disconnect between your daily and intimate life and that set of ideas. In this sense, he argues, I think quite forcefully, that there is something absolutely not only unique and distinct about Judaism, about halakha, but even something, very quietly he says this, even something superior. And I return just one last time to this sort of lovely picture, which I've always liked. And again, you look at this, and there's a wonderful domestic scene, and it's wonderful and tranquil. But were it only true, were it only true that Jews and Christians really have that kind of interaction. And never mind his sort of famous encounter with Lavate, but frankly, even with his closest friend, it's quite clear that they could not agree even on some basic principles, and I think therein lies a broader story. Thank you. I will end with this.
I just in the picture there's also a chess game going on, which is a kind of rivalry, and Mendelssohn is wearing red, same as those pieces on there. Just I thought that Oppenheim acknowledged that there was some rivalry going on there.
No, I said this at one point, but let's explore this together. I think the chessboard is there because it's also rivalry on neutral ground. You and I can sit, I don't care who you are, male, female, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, white, black, whatever it may be, whatever may separate us or not separate us, when you sit down on a chessboard, there's something, it's an international language, international moves, and that's it. It's totally on neutral ground. You have no advantage, I have no advantage, regardless of whatever politics, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I think. You're right. Obviously, it's engaging each other, but I think it's there precisely because it's engaging each other on neutral ground.
I think what we'll do is we'll take a few questions at a time so that you can ask one shot, sort of see how they
It seems quite interesting that Mendelssohn thought the history did not move forward, but of course he was a product of the Enlightenment, and you mentioned that he had probably a most unique Jewish radical philosophy that didn't exist before. So he's having his cake and eating it too, it would seem to me.
Having his cake and eating it too in?
He's moving forward with the Enlightenment. He's a product of progressive Jewish philosophy, and yet he's saying no ideas have moved forward since Har Sinai. It doesn't seem to fit. Oh, it's only all we are halacha. So what about his whole Jewish philosophy that didn't exist before? He says things that no one said before, and he certainly was a student of the Rambam and all of Jewish philosophy, which was a movement away from Talmudic Judaism or Rabbinic Judaism.
I think, thank you. Let me wait again. I have to remember the question, so. That's okay, go.
I guess the thing about...
Okay, the gentleman's requesting that I answer now. May I do that?
Can I just add a comment?
Okay,
because
sure.
My question actually kind of falls off of that question. I had a perception that Moshe Mendelssohn was like a radical person who was actually also trying to move Judaism a little closer to the Enlightenment and the feeling that I get from this presentation is he was actually a very staunch defender of Judaism in a situation where he, as you say, he couldn't be too extreme in his point of views. So I find that interesting. And I had another question concerning the story of the Three Rings and the play Nathan, or the following book. There seems to be like two different ideas there presented by Lessing.
Mm-hmm.
Two different ideas presented by Lessing. So he doesn't seem to be like a consistent person in terms of his ideas. So I was wondering if there's a progression, which one came first, like what was his final kind of standpoint, or whether he was just kind of playing with the ideas and didn't really have like a standard point of view.
No, well, let me begin with the last and then work my way backward. No, I first of all, you're right. There's something you're very perceptive. I would simply say that, sure, Lessing could speak of, you know, the fact that we cannot distinguish between the three faiths and, you know, perhaps angling towards a union of faith. But let's be really clear here. In his mind, whatever that faith, that universal faith would look like, it would look an awful lot like Protestant Christianity. Trust me, it wouldn't look like traditional rabbinic Judaism. He wasn't about to start instituting, you know, Hilchot Shabbat for the rest of the world. So that is to say that's right. He could obviously speak and envision and see this kind of glorious future, but it's really quite clear, and you're right about this, you know, about an inconsistency, that in his mind, though, it's not so inconsistent. It's that it's clear what the height of civilization is, and the height of civilization looks an awful lot like liberal Protestant Christianity.
Well, what I'm thinking is, it seems like they're playing with ideas so much that maybe we don't know what either of them really believed. I mean, it's like they were so much in the game, like the chess game, that
right.
Maybe it's hard to, you know, pin down. You know.
True, and that's true for many great thinkers. Let's go back to your first comment, and then I'm working my way back to Rabbi Kurzner's comment. That's right. Clearly, there's no question that my presentation of Mendelssohn is not the going one. The going view of Mendelssohn, of course, is very much informed. That's why I read little pieces of Heinrich Gretz, and there's this, you know, picture of Oppenheim. Again, interestingly enough, I sort of hinted at this before, that when you look at 19th and 20th century Jewish thinkers, there's almost a universal perception of Mendelssohn, which is very much the one that you shared with us, a very radical thinker, a man who broke with tradition, etc., etc. Both radical reform and ultra-Orthodoxy, they all agree, interestingly enough, that is the perception. They just evaluate it differently. For one, he might be a hero. For the other one, he's the world's biggest Rasha. The problem is, right through the whole spectrum, is that I don't think anyone's bothered to sit down and actually read the text and think about what's there. The minute you sit down and you consider this historically, and again, I make no bones about the fact that I have a certain, you know, argument to make and a certain way in which I view this, but I think the evidence is really very, very clear. Most people have always used the image of Mendelssohn to bandy about. By the way, on both sides of the issue, I don't think reformers have read him either. Mm-hmm. I don't think no one has bothered to read him. So you make with him what you want.
It sounds like that's very much the case.
So I would argue strongly against that. And to now end up with the comment that began this, I think were we to sort of invite Moses Mendelssohn to join us right here and, you know, start a discussion with him, I think, again, first of all, I think he would take seriously this idea that history doesn't progress. It doesn't mean, please don't read into that means history only regresses. He would say, no, it depends what. In certain ways, we've definitely become more sophisticated, but not in every way. He had a really healthy skepticism. And I think he had the ability to pick and choose, and he would say that's right. Any intellectual worth his or her weight would say that, you know, you should always pick and choose. There are aspects in our society today that we may embrace and say, ah, there's something that we've, you know, a point that we've gotten to, a certain wisdom or insight that perhaps our predecessors haven't, but we should hardly pretend that everything we're doing today is all, you know, ripe with wisdom, etc. I think he could clearly appreciate that society is, has that complexity. I mean, I think at minimum that is something that I would, you know, absolutely give to him. He more or less says this. That's why I don't think I'm just reading into him or pretending that I'd like him to say it. Secondly, your point about breaking with the past, again, that's although I would grant the point, but don't forget, when you read any Jewish thinker, when you read the Rambam, let's go back to that. The Rambam, did the Rambam really think he was breaking with what Chazal were doing? And yet, And again, this is a whole other discussion. But in the Rambam, we see an Aristotelianism and a Neoplatonism. We see all kinds of wonderful, complex, philosophical things going on that you and I would honestly say Chazal could not have imagined. And yet, what does the Rambam think he's doing? What the Rambam thinks he's doing is telling you exactly what Chazal thought. And he would insist that that's what they had in mind. So, once again, Mendelssohn, I think, plays the same card. No better or worse than, I think, any other Jewish thinker. Which is to say that you and I, of course, recognize something very distinctly 18th century about Mendelssohn. He is eating his cake. When the Rambam ate his cake, everybody eats their cake. When you ask them what he's doing, they'll tell you, but this is what Chazal meant. Did the Rambam really believe it? Okay, and I don't know either. Exactly. It. You're right. You are right. You are so right. And I'm stuck with the same I don't know that you are. Well, your question is a very good one. I mean, you know. I'm happy to hand over to Rabbi Wolf.
I want to ask you a different question if Mendelssohn is a product of his time. And it's not just that he's a product of his time versus the Enlightenment, but is he a product of his time vis-a-vis Jews as minority? Does he want a civil society because Jews aren't in power? Or, you know, what would he advocate for Israel today, both vis-a-vis Christians and vis-a-vis Muslims and vis-a-vis non-believing Jews? So in other words, is it only a necessity because, you know, if his halakha doesn't distinguish between public and private realms? If he's a real believer in halakha, then everything should be halakha. There is no private realm. There is no public realm. Everything's halachic. So, again, that's also kind of a cake and eating it too. It's only because it serves him well, because he wants to live in Christian society free. But if he was in control, maybe he wouldn't be like that. That's one. The other is, was there ever any thought about this parable of the three rings to turn it on its head? In other words, the idea that You divide it into, you know, the Alexander Haig scenario, that if you have three rulers and one's out of town and you have a crisis, the other one says, I'm in charge, and the others get offended. You know, the Alexander Haig kind of scenario.
I don't know. I don't know quite what to do with that, with your second comment. I appreciate it, though, but you're right. It's in a certain sense, of course, your two comments are linked in the sense that you're right. Beyond philosophy and ideas, we live in societies of majorities and minorities. And by the way, your opening comment, you were very much on the mark. I very much appreciate what you said, and you're right. Clearly, Mendelssohn is making the arguments at the time because he is also, at that very, very moment, struggling for, you know, or engaged in the debate for Jewish civic equality. It's a very, very young debate at the time. Really, it's just beginning to take place, and he very much wants Jews to gain their full rights, and you're absolutely right, this is part and parcel of that political vision as well, which is to say, you know, to respect each other and tolerance. And again, you are completely right in saying that how this would translate into a situation now that we have, of course, the State of Israel, that Jews are majority, you are so right. That would seem to be very problematic. The only thing I could say is that, again, we have to respect individuals in their own historical context. Mendelssohn could not for a second imagine a situation in which we have today, which is to say, he lived in a Galut situation, died in a Galut situation, and in fact, when he was challenged by a fellow Christian who said, no, Jews cannot gain their rights because they could never truly belong to our society because they're always turning to the east, to Daven, or wherever they're, you know, turning to from Germany, and they're always sort of imagining a future state. You know what he answers? He answers with what today is a classical Naturae Carta response. He cites exactly the same Gemara, exactly the same text, and basically says, God forbid, we are forbidden from even thinking about, you know, recreating or, you know, a state. We live in Galut until the time will come that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will signal us otherwise. But at that point, we're not in history anymore. We are, you know, beyond history and time. We are in something we would call Yemot HaMashiach. That's his answer. I mean, of all great ironies. But my only point is simply that, look, he dies in 1786. He can only see what he can see in his lifetime. And you're absolutely right. The implications of his ideas, I agree, and maybe his ideas, of course, completely fall apart, and we should not even you know, reach for them, maybe in a modern context, or maybe we should. How, you know what I mean? But that embroils us in a very, very modern debate of religion and rights and minorities and majorities. But that's the 21st, you know, the 20th and the 21st century. And that's why we have thinkers who grapple with these ideas today. As you and I both well know, there are no simple answers. Actually, the whole question is, you know, now complicated even more and more. And, you know, to sort of speculate on what, you know, what Mendelssohn would have said or would have done, you're right, I don't know. But you're right. Like any other great thinker, the ideas are very much the ideas, you know, of a moment. And I think what we choose to take forward and is a very tricky proposition.
If I may, I just want to make a comment and then ask you to make a comment on the notion, if the Rambam believed, you know, there's a famous comment of the Rav when they asked him, when all the insights his grandfather, Rav Chaim, he had in the Rambam, so they asked the Rav, one of the students, do you really think this is what he meant? Did the Rambam really mean the Bechidish in Rav Chaim? And the Rav said, it's irrelevant. The fact that great literature, we know, and great ideas can be found in the Rambam, whether the Rambam like meant it is irrelevant. So in a certain sense, the Rambam probably had the same thing. Whether it was meant in Chazal, perhaps he would argue isn't relevant, but from Chazal we can have that idea. So I don't know how that plays, and if you want to comment on that. The other comment...
I can't do better than Rav Chaim.
No, but I'm just saying on the concept, on the Rambam, the other comment, I'm just, you know, kind of, we live in an era where people are not really interested in philosophical ideas. At least that's what I see, especially in the Jewish world and especially in the Orthodox Jewish world. There seems to be almost no interest in philosophical ideas. The interest is very much halachic orientation. I also agree it's the essence of Judaism, but it's not the only part of Judaism. And perhaps I just really would ask you to comment, you know, Mendelssohn, I think, is ignored. Definitely, in the yeshivish world, he's a total apikoros, the founder of the Reform movement, etc. But even in the modern Orthodox world, I can tell you in all my schooling, I never once, even in YU, was there anything ever exposure to any Mendelssohn. I'm just like curious... Why Hirsch is such an important thinker, and they don't live that far apart, and I think some of their ideas are not so radically different. Why Hirsch is so important, and Mendelssohn is like totally ignored in the modern Orthodox world? If you have any comments on that.
Well, I would begin by saying to some degree what I've done in the talk, you know, I think I could roll over here, which is to say again, this is about memory and meaning. It's about images and I think realities. We have various images. We also have an image of Hirsch. And we create images of Hirsch. And Hirsch has been used, for example, as much as we tend to think, oh, Hirsch is a great figure within the quote-unquote, you know, centrist or modern Orthodox community, you know as well as I do that Hirsch is also a hero in the Aguda community. Now, what is going on here? Well, part of what's going on is a battle for the image of Hirsch, which might not have to do with the reality. You and I... Exactly. That was my next comment, which is to say... And my teacher, Septimus, showed this about the Rambam. There's always a struggle for great figures. Why? Because if I could say that you said what I say, then, you know, I have someone, to be samech on. So I say that, so you're right, your comment is very appropriate. What you're really saying is that we will struggle with the image of Hirsch, we'll struggle with the image of the Rambam, we'll struggle with the image of the Rav, of Rav Soloveitchik. We don't bother struggling with the image of Mendelssohn. You're absolutely right. He doesn't even enter the picture. But again, you know, what's interesting, by the way, historically, is that in the 19th century, this was absolutely not true. Everybody had a take on Mendelssohn. Everybody cited Mendelssohn. Hirsch, no less than anybody else. Hirsch viewed Mendelssohn as a great individual, spoke about him in virtually the same breath as the Rambam, etc., etc. The real historical point here, and again, you are so right, is what happened at the end of the 19th century, because that's when the image changes. You know, through the 19th century, there is everybody, in some ways, mentions Mendelssohn, cites Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn's Biur, his Bible project, was the most printed Chumash, except for Chumash with Rashi. You think the Chumash with Rashi, every printer prints the Chumash with Rashi. There's a gazillion 19th century copies of Chumash with Rashi. The second most popular Chumash is Mendelssohn's Chumash, which virtually every Jewish home had.
Even in Eastern Europe?
Less so, but even in Eastern Europe. a little bit less so, but even in Eastern Europe. How do I mean, again, I could fast forward. How do I know this? Because of the, you know, some people have heard me say this, the grandchildren of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who I know personally, will tell me that in his Kitvei Yad, he's always citing Mendelssohn. He had a copy of Mendelssohn's Biur. It was like, this is what you had on your bookshelf. If you were a learned individual, you know, it's one of the things you had. Rav Ruderman had a copy. They all had a copy. These are all, of course, Eastern European. They're smart.
They say such things. You can't say this in public.
It's the truth. It's the absolute truth.
Ramosha Chick, who was one of the great extremists on this issue, I mean, said it's his Rebbe, the Chassam Sofer, had it and used it. He has it now, but he doesn't.
No, so you're right. But much of what's interesting here is exactly, and that's why, let's leave Mendelssohn, which is a thing of lesser importance here, and just realize that on every single subject that we can raise, there really is image, and then there's something a little bit beyond the image, what I would call truth and reality. And I think we have to work hard enough, and we have to be honest enough to work away from images and think, you know, clearly and carefully about what exactly, you know, were they saying, what happened. That is our task.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll take a 10-minute break for coffee.